Blog Talk Radio.
I was toting my pack along the dusty Winnemucca Road, when along came a semi with a high-end canvas covered load. If you're going to Winnemucca, Mac, with me you can ride. And so I climbed into the cab and then I settled down inside. He asked me if I'd seen a road with so much dust and sand, and I said, listen, I've traveled every road in this here land. I've been everywhere, man, I've been everywhere, man. Across the deserts bare, man, I breathe the mountain air, man. Of travel I've had my share, man, I've been everywhere. I've been to Reno, Chicago, Fargo, Minnesota, Buffalo, Toronto, Winslow, Sarasota, Wichita, Tulsa, Ottawa, Oklahoma, Tampa, Panama, Mattawa, La Paloma, Bangor, Baltimore, Salvador, Amarillo, Tocopilla, Barranquilla, and Padilla. I'm a killer. I've been everywhere, man. I've been everywhere, man. Across the deserts bare, man. I breathe the mountain air, man. Travel, I've had my share, man. I've been everywhere. I've been to Boston, Charleston, Dayton, Louisiana, Washington, Houston, Kingston, Texas, down to Monterey, Faraday.
It's time for the next edition of the Riveting Jumble Justice Radio Show, broadcast worldwide on Blog Talk Radio. Turn up your speakers and listen closely, since you may be asked questions later. Keep your phone handy, since we encourage you to call in your comments to the host and guests on today's show. The listener call-in number is 347-996-5983. Once again, the number is 347-996-5983. You will also find the number on the top of the homepage for the Jumble Justice Radio Show. I'm Audrey, your technical and spiritual advisor for the radio broadcast. And now, without further delay, allow me to introduce your eminently qualified and inspiring host for Jumble Justice, Professor Keith Haley.
Well, thank you very much, Audrey. We always shoot for riveting to be our success mark on the show, but I don't know if we've ever made it, have we, Mike? We'll have to see. But yes, this is your host, Keith Haley, who sometimes has the mind for radio and always has the face for it. We want to thank Johnny Cash on that song he sings for us. I love that song. And by the way, Johnny, if you're riding on that truck going through Phoenix, Arizona this week, or earlier in the week, boy, did you see the flood they were having out there in Arizona? My gosh, talk about water, people getting washed away and all kinds of things. I thought we got kind of moderate news coverage about that, actually, back here in the Midwest, at least up in Northwest Ohio. But anyway, thank the good Lord that it wasn't you who was involved in that that kind of business. But here we are again. We want to thank Audrey, Mike Sorrento, Lucy Spears, all of us doing work, all of them doing work for us on preparing this show. And tonight's going to be interesting, at least to me. We're going to be listening to, yes, we're going to bleed off of C-SPAN radio again, Book TV. And, of course, that's what Brian Lamb made it for, so that people could listen to books being presented if they didn't have time to read them. And tonight we're going to have Stephen Halbrook. And he is an attorney and a research fellow at the Independent Institute in an interesting place. If you've never looked at their website, there's a lot of stuff down on there. But his topic tonight is going to be something that he goes in a little bit in-depth about it. He's an attorney and a researcher, a very good researcher. And the title of his book that he's going to be talking about is Gun Control and the Third Reich, Disarming the Jews and the, quote, Enemies of the State, unquote. Very interesting story. People say, okay, of course, Hitler and people before him, the Nazis, you know, the communists took away guns from people, but this guy has the whole story. And it's a very good book, and I think, and I'm going to buy this one and actually read it, but he has really done research on it, and you'll see that as he makes his presentation tonight. So we won't be able to hear it all. Of course, they're always over an hour. But you could go on booktv.org and listen to Stephen Halbrook, H-A-L-B-R-O-O-K, and his book is Gun Control and the Third Reich. And the subtitle is Disarming the Jews and the Enemies of the State. So anyway, I think you'll enjoy that. You're listening on Blog Talk Radio. Remember, you can do it yourself. All you have to do is sign up within probably 2 minutes, 3 minutes, you can have your own radio show, and you can broadcast worldwide in streaming audio at no cost to you, unless you broadcast between 7 and 10 or 8 to 10, something like that, and that doesn't cost much. That's what we're doing. But you can, who would ever believe that, you know, here's radio for anyone that wants to do their own radio show, or any group of people that wants to do it. A lot of these shows have, you know, panels regularly and that type of thing. So anyway, it's a great service. We dedicate this to those energetic and tireless police, court, corrections, and juvenile justice professionals who protect us throughout the United States and around the world. We'll have some good news about some of them tonight. Some of it's a little bit humorous when we talk about the sheriff in Florida, but I'll save that for the news segment of the show. So remember, you can have your show, and all you have to do is you go ahead and do it. I told you what tonight's show is about. And we'll have our usual segments here. We're going to talk about a blonde joke here to start with. And Audrey's dug this one out for us. And let's see if I can recover this blonde joke. I thought this was kind of an interesting one. I don't think we've used this one before. I mark them off when I use them in Esmond Floyd's little book, 1001 Ways to Save the Planet. Is that the title? I think it is. But here's the blonde joke for tonight. What do you think of this? A beautiful blonde decides to start a handyman business. That sounds sexist. Start a handyman business after having some work done around her house because the guy said he makes tons of money. So she gets business cards made and puts signs on her car. So she goes into this rich neighborhood and knocks on the door of this huge house with a huge wraparound front porch. So a guy answers the door and asks what she wants. She tells him her business, and he thinks for a minute, gee, I was thinking about repainting my Porsche and even have the paint for it. I bought the paint. How much would you charge? She looks around and says, I guess about $400. She tells him that she's all done. She gets the job done in about an hour, and she knocks on the door. He comes to the door, and she tells him that she's all done. And the guy can't believe it. Wow, he says, wow. He didn't say awesome, but he did say wow. Wow, that's great, he says. She says, I even did 2 coats, she tells him. So he starts to hand her the money, and then he looks down into the driveway to see his newly painted Porsche automobile. His newly painted Porsche automobile. I like that blonde joke. And ladies and gentlemen, due to the crime rates and all that business and people who have concealed carry license, they must be committing crimes, right? They wouldn't be responsible citizens like the requirements in every state require for you to get a concealed carry license, except one state doesn't have any, except I think all you have to do is not be a felon or not have a arrest record. But anyway, we're going to play the Ohio Coalition Against Firearms. They have a message they want you to heed.
Carrying concealed handguns in Ohio? It's a deadly idea. A message from the Ohio Coalition Against Gun Violence.
Thank you very much, Ohio Coalition. We need to get that message out regularly and often, and we try to do that on our radio show. We've been doing it for years. I think someday I better check and see if they still exist, the Ohio Coalition. I think they must, actually. All right, we need a green tip. You know, the planet has been getting warmer. Of course, no, it has not since 1996, but there's always the chance that this thing could turn around, as Al Gore has said, and we'll be boiling, and the ice caps will be melting, Antarctica, I mean, it'll just go, and we'll all be floating. So I hope you've bought a kayak, at least, to save yourself. If you want to save some paper in the home, that's a way to save, that's the planet, you know, let's don't consume more paper than we need to. Time your morning schedule so that your I hate to say this, but your number two happens when you arrive at work. Okay, there is a little downside to this. Office toilet paper is generally only good for sanding decks. Oh, that's cruel. That's a little bit off color. I shouldn't have done that one tonight, but I thought that was a funny one, and I hope you enjoy it. Okay, what we're going to do now is look at some news and really some interesting things going on here tonight. One of the big arguments that's going on, I mentioned it here in the last several weeks again, but it never stops, is should campus police be getting military equipment, surplus military equipment under what they call this 1033 program that the Department of Defense and Congress, I guess, has approved. Should they be doing that? Should the campus police, for example, the University of Central Florida, ever need a modified grenade launcher, one sits waiting in the department's armory, retooled to fire tear gas canisters? The weapon was used several years ago for training purposes. It hasn't left storage since that time. Here's others, a community college. What did they do? They had, located in Western Mississippi, they had two. The woman who worked for the department declined to say that their grenade, she had a grenade launcher too, had been repurposed to shoot flares, but the college no longer possessed it. All right, both institutions received their launchers from this program with the Department of Defense, and at least 117 colleges in America have acquired equipment from them. And there's a big talk about the militaristic business of the police. We've had Baldo's on here presenting his book, Militarization of the American Police. And Ferguson, Missouri has brought all this out because they showed up in, you know, not tanks, but what do you call them, you know, militarized vehicles, whatever, armor vehicles, that type of thing, at least one or two of them. What are they going to do? Campus police departments have used the money to obtain military equipment as mundane as men's trousers. In fact, I'm not going to do it, but you can see a table of all the equipment of the 117 colleges. Some of them have things like they've gotten a hammer from the Defense Department. Okay. So, you know, in other words, instead of dumping the stuff down the drain or in the ocean or storing it forever, the military's getting rid of it. Central Florida acquired 23 M16 assault rifles during the Department of Defense. Don't get me started on what's an assault rifle. I mean, is a double-barrel shotgun an assault rifle? It makes pretty good assaults for some people, but you know what an M16, you hold a trigger down, just keeps shooting. But, you know, most people call an assault weapon anything that looks ugly, but they have weapons that do exactly the same thing that look like hunting rifles, and I won't go into details on that. But anyway, since Michael Brown and the cop showed up with some high-security type of equipment, Senator Claire McCaskill, a Democrat from Missouri, heads the Oversight Committee for the Senate Homeland Security and Government Affairs Committee. She had a hearing on Tuesday to consider revisions in this 1033 program. She suggested that local police departments that enjoy cost savings from free military equipment be required to have 200 hours of training. Ms. McCaskill, Senator McCaskill, training in what? How to use the hammer? Some of these things, when you see on that list, if you just go online and look at 1033 equipment or colleges, in fact, I'll give you the, or Dan Bauman, you can Google that under and find out his article on campus policing, on campus grenade launchers, M16s, and armed vehicles. But what would we get the training on? Like I said, how to use a hammer and a screwdriver and that type of thing. But, you know, I love Congress to be on vacation because they're not making more regulations, and now they're back. And here we are, Tuesday of this week, they're going to make probably cops to get some of this equipment. Some of it's like paint. They're going to have to get 200 hours of training on how to do that. If you're going to give you the money, she says, we're going to make you jump through a few hoops. Well, that makes sense, doesn't it? Oh, my gosh. Usually she's a little sharper than that. Now more than 8,000 federal and state law enforcement agencies, many of them campus, are eligible to participate in all this business. Unbelievable. And, of course, some of these chiefs of police say this stuff is never going to show up on their campus. You know, if there's a riot and fires and the place is falling down, they may drag out one of these militaristic looking vehicles, but it's not going to happen as a regular basis. And the article goes in depth. Two people arguing. Linda Stump, the University of Florida's police chief, says transparency is the key. You know, we're not trying to hide this stuff as armored truck from people. They've had it since 2007. So it just goes on and on. Mr. Kraska, where is he? He's at Eastern Kentucky. He doesn't think this is a... He started adding weaponry, battle dress uniforms, all the advanced military technologies. That small agency could go rapidly from one of protecting and serving to one of viewing the community as the enemy. What do you mean? You put on a uniform, a change uniform, and it makes you a soldier or a combat attack soldier? You know, I don't think it does that. And Mr. Perry, another professor, he says, Florida State, this is overdone, and I happen to agree with him. Missouri, execution is the eighth in the state this year. Missouri inmate convicted of a 1998 robbery and a double murder was put to death Wednesday, the eighth execution in the state this year and the 10th since November. This Earl Ringo Jr., an accomplice, killed a delivery driver, Dennis Poyser, and a manager trainee, Joanna Basinger, at a Ruby Tuesdays in Columbia in the early hours of the morning on July 4th, 1998. They finally got around to executing him. And he wiggled his feet in the process. We have all these people watch these executions. He breathed deeply a few times. Then he closed his eyes, and it was all done in a matter of seconds. The governor, Nixon, had refused to halt the execution over concerns raised by Ringo's attorney, who, among other things, questioned Missouri's use of a pre-execution sedative called midazolam. I don't know how to pronounce that, M-I-D-A-Z-O-L-A-M, midazolam, I guess, and because the midazolam could dull Ringo's senses and leave him unable to express any pain. You know, we want to take all the pain out of an execution. We take the pain out of the murder. I mean, we ought to be civil about it. There's no question about it. But, deep down there, I'm against execution, but I understand them. I mean, one of the reasons we have them is justice. They deserve what they got based on what they did. But anyway, you're going to hear more about that. You know, the knockout game that's become so popular, particularly in, by blacks, you see tons of them. I've recorded 82 or downloaded 82 videos on this knockout game stuff, and I'm going to do some writing about it probably later on. This is Dayton, Ohio. A 17-year-old boy was convicted on charges of attacking and robbing two men as part of the so-called knockout game, and he's been sentenced to 4 years in prison. He was convicted as an adult of two counts. In other words, they waived him over to the adult court. He and two other teens were charged in attacks on homeless men in Dayton last spring. And those of you who've ever listened to the radio show before may have heard I was a Dayton cop way back in the Ice Age. The police department had the longest recruit training program in the state of Ohio, the highest salary, and I think the most selective. College graduates were in my class as a recruit. But anyway, I worked a downtown beat for a long time and saw many homeless people, and they come in variety, believe me. Some are college graduates. Some have no intention of ever living anywhere except on the street. They love it. And our guy down there that was arrested for drunk arrest, he lived out on the street. I think he was arrested 200 and some times for drunk. But anyway, we're finally doing something about this. Can you imagine this? This is fun. I just saw one again last week. I forget. I think that was New York City, but don't quote me on that. You know, here's a couple walking down the street, and these guys walking down the street, not only they get to them, they punch them right in the face and knock them down and kick them in the head and stand them. You know what ends the knockout game? The shoot-up game. Those have a concealed carry license. I'll bet they can change the knockout attack plan very quickly. I think it's ridiculous. I mean, this is fun now for children and young people to go beat somebody up on the street, and they've hurt people and some have died from this. I don't know what the details are on that, but I'll research it later on. Heroin. Have you found heroin in your community? It's everywhere. It's like having a can of Altoids for a container of Altoids. Now it's absolutely everywhere. This is an Ohio case also, but a Delhi Township couple in Ohio will face charges for allegedly selling heroin that led to a woman's overdose death. Christopher and Stephanie Eaglin are charged with manslaughter in the death of Shea Frick. Delhi police said that Eaglin sold heroin to Frick on June 26. She died in her home from an overdose that particular evening. I cannot believe how we've let this go. And Attorney General Mike DeWine, I agree with, he'd been there a long time. I do, Mike, when I was the head of a state agency. And he says they're working on changing the law so that they can charge these dealers more with these drug overdose deaths or more often. And I think that's a great idea. Who would ever believe that heroin is everywhere? And we wanted drug courts. I mentioned that last week. Yeah, they're great. Drug courts, I mean, even Cleveland stopped there years ago. They probably got them back now. But anyway, really something. How about this one? I think I'll finish with this one. 11 families whose loved ones were killed by condemned murderers got a call from the state this week. Those scheduled executions will not happen, at least for now. Some wonder if death sentences handed down by judges and juries will ever be carried out. For most families involved in the latest decision, those sentences were decades ago. Here's the case. Think of this one. A little girl named Amber Garrett. The 10-year-old girl was taken from her mother's home in Harrison, Ohio, in 1991. The girl's body was found 3 days later in Bright, Indiana. That's a city. She was beaten to death and stabbed 11 times in the chest and neck. That night, Amber disappeared. Family friend Jeffrey Wolgenstahl was seen driving through town with the little girl in his car. Later, her DNA was found inside the vehicle. He was convicted of murder. In 1991. We're still waiting to execute him, and now his execution is set for May of 2015. Can you believe that? And these people are waiting for justice, and one of the things the family says, we're just getting tired of hearing about this. All we hear about is April and Amber's cousin, you know, said April Garrett, Amber's cousin. She says, it gets harder every year. You keep hearing about the case. I mean, one of the things the death penalty does, or carrying out any sentence, it brings closure to a case. So these cases aren't closed. And of course, I told you, I opened up my guns book of Liberty and Guns for All, talking about my good friend who was murdered in a robbery by two people, blew his head off with a double barrel shotgun. His perpetrator, number one perpetrator with the shotgun, got life in prison, and he did 12 years. Sentenced in 1982, and he got out in 1994. Can you believe it? And unfortunately, he didn't do that in Texas and Oklahoma, because we wouldn't even be talking about this. He would be gone. Well, anyway, that's enough of the news tonight, and I went overboard on some of these things. But let's go ahead and take a look at this whole idea of guns. You know, I am not a gun nut. I'm not. But I do understand that 97% of people who use a firearm to ward off a criminal don't shoot them. They take it out, and the criminal takes off. So less than 3% of the time, your enemies of gun possession and right to carry would certainly say different, because they don't know the facts half the time. Less than 3% of the time do they actually use the firearm. So what we're going to do tonight is listen to what happened in Germany. Germany knows, you know, in America, we have hundreds of thousands of firearms all over the country. So if somebody's going to ever take over the country, or criminals are going to take over a community, guess what? They're going to have trouble doing that. I won't talk about Switzerland, but he probably will in his presentation. But we're going to listen now then to Stephen Halbrick and how what important he thinks it is that we have the right to possess and the right to carry, and how that might have made a difference in the third gun, or the Third Reich in Germany. So give me some time here to set this up, and we'll go. this is Book TV, and sometimes it gets busy. I'm not criticizing them for that because they're a great organization, but give me time to get it set up. It's thinking.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. My name is David Thoreau, and I'm the founder and president of the Independent Institute. I'm delighted to welcome you this evening. This is another meeting of a program of ours called the Independent Policy Forum. And in addition to our audience here at our conference center in Oakland, California, I want to welcome our viewers on C-SPAN and also those who are joining with us worldwide who are live streaming online. The Independent Policy Forum is a...
I'm going to move this up a little bit to get to the speaker. He talks quite a bit about the Institute, but...
We're delighted to have our old friend, Dr. Stephen Hallberg, with us. To require registration of either all firearms or all handguns in the U.S. As a Nazi theorist, and I think there might be one or two of the books on Kristallnacht that might have a footnote or
okay, this is Mr. Halbert.
But that's about it. And I want to say right at the beginning, the title of this presentation has to do with, are there lessons to be learned? And I think the lessons speak for themselves. I will not engage in the kind of discourse in which I would say that some proponent of some legislation that's Nazi-like or that, that these are Gestapo tactics or anything like that. I don't think we need to engage in that kind of rhetoric. There's too much of that that goes on. But one thing that is clear is that there's been a lot of denial about what took place in Nazi Germany. And it's time that the historical record be made clear, and that's what I set out to do in the book many years ago. I actively wrote the book and did research. Clear, and that's what I've unmentioned whatsoever, and if you see any mention, I think there might be one or two of the books on Kristallnacht that might have a footnote or something, but that's about it. And I want to say right at the beginning, the title of this presentation has to do with, are there lessons to be learned? And I think the lessons speak for themselves. I will not engage in political reliability myth. Garner. Many years ago, I actively wrote the book and did research for it for about 15 years, because being that the sources are either in English or German, published sources don't deal with this topic. It was necessary to do a lot of archival research in Germany. I did some myself. I also retained one of the best archival researchers in Germany who does this topic, who knows these record groups very well. And we came to some very interesting conclusions that are presented in the book. But historically, the way it all started was right at the end of the Great War, 1918, 1919, there were communist uprisings in Germany, the monarch fell, the Weimar Republic was established, and there was a virtual civil war. And I will do a little bit of show and tell. I don't have any the street scenes to show you from that period, but if you've ever seen any documentaries on it, you'll see people running every which way and machine guns in the streets and the steel helmets and the Freikorps, which was the basically voluntary group that sided with the government to repress the communist uprisings. They wanted an uprising that like had taken place in Russia, a Bolshevik-type coup. And so there was quite a lot of chaos. And then under the Versailles Treaty, there was the idea in Germany that either all arms or all military arms had to be surrendered, including by civilians. So there were actually legal interpretations in Germany that no civilian could own any gun and they all had to be turned in. And there were actually court cases about this during the early 1920s. But things calmed down somewhat, but then we hit to 1923, you have the Great Inflation, and you have a communist uprising in Hamburg, which was ruthlessly put down, and then you have Hitler's beer hall putsch in Munich, where they actually seized the beer hall, but they didn't succeed in seizing the state. Interesting phenomenon. It's probably pretty easy to seize a beer hall in this country. But so then he goes and writes Mein Kampf, and when he's in prison, and things calmed down a lot after that. Though in 1928, however, the Reichstag passed a Waffengesetz or gun control law that was the first of its kind in Germany, and it required a lot of record keeping. There was no registration system, but there were records to be kept that could be subject to police inspection. And a curious thing about it is there was no debate in the legislature or the Reichstag. It passed without any debate whatever, which would be a phenomenon in itself. But things started getting rearing up again as we approached the 30s. And in 1931, for the first time, Germany adopted legislation or a decree. There were legislative decrees that the executive branch could make, and it called for a registration of the German states that adopted it. So you had like Berlin and most of the large jurisdictions adopting firearm registration, and some areas did not do so, but by and large most places did. Because in 1931, but before this took place, there were the Nazi Party had declared itself in favor of legal elections by that point. But there was an incident at a hotel called Boxheimer, and there was an individual named Werner Best who was a Nazi theoretician, and he was heavily involved with the SA, the Stormtroopers, and the document had purported to deal with if there was a communist revolt and the Nazis needed to seize power, which many people interpreted to mean this was a plan for a Nazi seizure of power. And it had things like there would be rationing of food, Jews would not get any food supplies, and it had a provision that everyone would be ordered to turn in their firearms within 24 hours or they would be executed. So this individual, Werner Best, actually would go on to become an official in the Gestapo, and we'll hear from him a little bit more this evening. But these documents were discovered, and they weren't taken too seriously. Nonetheless, there was still a lot of street fighting going on between the communists and the Nazis. They were basically armed thugs in the streets. And so it was decided in December of 1931 that the executive branch would decree this firearm registration legislation. Now, at that time, the Republic, the executive branch, could rule by decree. You hear a lot about executive decrees today. Well, this allowed the executive branch basically to not bother consulting the legislative branch at all and simply make decrees, and this was one of them. In fact, this decree covered a lot of subjects, and the Reichskanzler at that time, and now we'll test my electronic abilities, Heinrich Brüning, basically the head of the German government, and there was something called the Enabling Act, which allowed the executive branch, as I said, to issue these decrees, and that's what he did, and that was one thing that the Weimar Republic adopted that was a horrible precedent, because when the Nazis came to power, they could rule by decree just as well. And so this one particular decree, if I can move to that, this is like the decree about internal security, and it's about misuse of weapons. But when you look at the first provision, this Section 1 provided for registration of all firearms by all people. And then it had a provision, 2 here, which stated that any time the officials, the authorities, decided it was needed for public security, they could require everybody who registered their firearms to turn them in. Now, that's an interesting thing to put in a firearm registration law. It was quite honest, wasn't it, that they would admit, because when you have firearm basically registration, debated and proposed, that's always, we'll never confiscate them. Well, here they had it right in the law that the authorities can decree it's a public emergency and they have to confiscate all firearms and there's a duty to turn them in, and you'll be incarcerated if you don't. So that came down in right before Christmas of 31, and the equivalent to our Attorney General, the Interior Minister, Wilhelm Gorner, sent out a directive saying that you have to be very careful with these registration records. This went to the officials who were keeping them. We don't want them to fall into the hands of extremist groups or radical elements. And so he actually said, don't keep them at the local police departments, put them in more centralized facilities for safekeeping. And so that was the directive, and I assume that's what they did. They didn't have computers, obviously, at that time. But they did get the IBM punch card technology by the time the Nazis came into power. How many of you remember that? I remember those very well. There was a lot of that technology in our own lifetime still, before this electronic business. So, but they could pull like registration records for gun owners or Jews or Protestants, Catholics, the whole works. They had all the records on everything. So 1933, Hitler and his party comes to power, and they immediately start attacking physically their political enemies. That would be Social Democrats, the party who had probably had more power than any other during the Weimar period as a single party, but also liberal parties, conservative parties. They multiplied day by day. The more opposition that arose, the more this repression would happen. And all opposition was invariably called communist, so that if you opposed what the Nazis were doing, you were a communist. And if you read the newspapers at that time, you'll find on a daily basis accounts of searches and seizures of firearms and arrests of so-called communists. So that goes on 1933, and you had the use of the firearm records. I have a whole chapter actually on this, the case of Brandenburg, where I got the records of a directive from Hermann Göring came down, who was a high official in the Nazi regime, and he basically said you need to check the political reliability of all persons with firearm permits. And so I actually found records where local authorities went through and good evening, ladies and gentlemen. My name is...
Didn't kill him, but...
Hellsdorf, our document from 1931. And when the Nazis came to power, Best had that guy arrested, and he was mysteriously killed while trying to escape, to alleviate the harsher and harsher conditions. But he's making this policy statement that you have to look at the political reliability, and in most cases we don't think Jews are politically reliable, meaning that they're not Nazi supporters, and therefore you have to be very careful about issuing gun permits to Jews, and basically he's advising don't do it. And it's got to be basically approved by Gestapo officials. You're not just going to, you know, the local police are not going to just issue these permits. And so this was from the Gestapo, and this was addressed to the Gestapo and the Gestapo, which is part of a kind of underling of the Gestapo, and to all the other relevant police agencies. So here you have... nothing had changed in the law. The Jews were eligible for the gun permit. So one thing... Going back to the Weimar law, to get a permit to acquire a gun or to carry a gun, you had to meet certain criteria. You had to be trustworthy. So anybody who was considered untrustworthy by the authorities, you don't get your gun permit. So they had a discretionary issuance, as we would call it today. And so I think it shows you the danger of language like that if you have subjective language that allow authorities to decide who gets the permit as opposed to objective criteria like convicted felon, mental incompetent, things like that. So this is Werner Best. Just another footnote on him was there had been a Nazi turncoat who had revealed that Boxheimer document from 1931. And when the Nazis came to power, Best had that guy arrested, and he was mysteriously killed while trying to escape. And so he was tried at some of the Nuremberg cases, and he was not executed, but he was in prison for a while and lived to tell the tale. But he did have that the guy murdered that had revealed those documents. So now we move on to getting toward 1938. We'll come back then. As time went on, the economic screws were tightening. Jewish assets were being confiscated, and conditions were getting very harsh. This was before the Star of David had to be warned. That was later, but Jews who could get out were doing so. There were many who they considered themselves Germans, and many of them very conservative German patriots, and they were not about to leave. They thought there would be an end to this at some point. So, but we come to a time when conditions were getting very bad in September and October of 1938. This would not be revealed until Kristallnacht, but there was a disarming of Jews going on by the authorities. And again, some of the people I've got in the book you've never heard of, but they were famous Nazi officials at the time. And the guy over here you recognize, that's Himmler. This is the police president of Berlin named Helmsdorf, and he's going to figure prominently in this story. He would orchestrate the disarming of the Berlin Jews in October, September, October 1938, and he had quite an interesting experience in terms of he had been in the SA. He was a really gung-ho Nazi. He was heavily involved in disarming the Jews in 1938. But when Kristallnacht came, as police president, he strongly objected to those kind of tactics because basically Hitler unleashed these brown shirts to go wild in the streets. That's not the kind of thing that a police chief would appreciate. But he was not in Berlin at the time. He was in Munich. 1944, Helmsdorf had joined the opposition to Hitler. And when the vomit attack took place in July 20, 1944, and it was Stauffenberg and his conspirators were exposed and rounded up, Helmsdorf was part of that conspiracy. And he would be one of those who would be tried at the trials that took place after that and then hung by piano wire. And so he made an honorable end. But that was the case with, I guess, some of the opposition to Hitler. They had been part of the Nazi party and a lot of the bad things that it did, but then they came around to a point where, whether it was because they'd had enough of the oppression of the Jews or because Hitler was, like, becoming an idiot, couldn't win the war, we're going to get him. We just passed the 70th anniversary just 4 days ago of July 20, 1944 to 2014, quite a historic day of when the bomb went off, and unfortunately, some idiot had moved it away from Hitler and didn't kill him. But Helmsdorf plays a prominent role in the disarming of the German Jews, and here we have an article from November the 9th of 1938, and this article it was not published that they were disarming the Jews until I think it was November the 8th, there was a Polish Jewish teenager who walked into the German embassy in Paris and shot a German diplomat. not a very high up official at all, but it was just the kind of event that the Nazi regime could latch on to justify what it was about to do. It could be, the conventional story was this young teenager, Herschel Greenspan, had relatives who were Polish Jews, and they were deported from Germany, and they were in really oppressive conditions and whatever. Was he trying to get revenge for that, or was he himself manipulated by Nazi agents so that a Jew would kill somebody, and then they would have the excuse to launch the pogrom that came next, Reichskristallnacht or Night of the Broken Glass. But the article talks about in the last few weeks, it doesn't give a starting date, Jews are being disarmed. Anschlussen, the Berliner Jew, disarming the German Jews. It tells you they supposedly seized 2,569 hand weapons, 1,702 Schusswaffen or guns, and 20,000 cartridges. What kind of bureaucrat do you have to be to, like, count cartridges? I don't know. And it goes on to explain that the Jews, it has been made emphatically known to the Jews in Berlin, they have to turn in their guns and other weapons, and who knows what they consider to be a hand weapon, like a letter opener or a dagger would be, but it was made known to them, the article states, by, I suspect, putting up notices in the Jewish quarters in Berlin, maybe word of mouth. We do know that they had the records on all gun owners, Jewish gun owners. Berlin had registration, and the Nazis had information on, you know, in Germany at that time, when you were born, they would put down in the records whether you were Jewish, Protestant, Catholic. So they had all these records they could correlate. And so the notice was given to them, and the article says that some of them, we had to use harsher means to let them know because they weren't turning them in. And curiously, it says that those without licenses were required to turn them in, but the order went out for all of them to turn them in. We have that document because we're going to get to an instance next that exemplifies the fact that all of them were required to turn in their guns. So this was published. It was the first notice to the world that the Jews were being disarmed in Germany, and this was summarized and published in the New York Times and other papers, prominent papers in the U.S., Britain, countries like that. And now we go back in history a lot, and we'll bring it right up to that same period again in a moment. The gentleman in the middle here is Alfred Platov. He was a three-time gold medal winner in the Olympics in 1896 in gymnastics. And the fellows on his left and right are two other gymnasts who were prominent German Olympic stars at that time. Alfred Platov was Jewish. That didn't make much difference in those days. And he went on to become a top figure in German athletics in terms of promoting gymnastics and writing theory about it from a scientific basis, and he became quite a prominent individual. And as we'll see in a moment, he made the mistake of registering some guns and was picked up for that. But what happened later in his life was that he was, you know, when they had the Olympics in Berlin in 1936, all the former Olympic champions were invited to that as special guests, but Alfred Platov, the Jewish guy, would not attend because by that point there was so much repression against Jews, he didn't want to dignify the regime because Jews were being severely attacked at that time, but then Hitler called it off so they could kind of clean up their act for the Olympics and make a good show to the world. So he refused to go. And then we turn the clock up to 1938. In just a moment, we'll go over what happened to him in terms of his guns. But by 1942, the war had come about. They were wearing the Star of David, and he was deported to the Theresienstadt concentration camp. It was kind of a concentration camp for intellectuals and people like that who were not the – it was not the worst one in the world probably for that reason. But within just a few weeks of being there, he was starved to death, and so that he met his end that way. But now we get to the reason why I'm talking about him. The book had – there was a lot of detective work going on with this book. My archivist in Germany found some arrest reports of Jews in the weeks before Kristallnacht, and he sent them to me, and we didn't know the significance of this one until I started researching it. But at the top it says, report about a political case. So the regime had the police could arrest you for political reasons, and that's what this is. And we started looking at the information on it, and that's Alfred Platov. It's got his date of birth and place of birth, Danzig, and his current address. And I didn't know who this guy was, and I just Googled Alfred Platov, and born on that date and place of birth, and it turns out to be this Olympic star. So that made it pretty interesting. And then it has political affiliation, and it says Jew. That's a weird political affiliation. And, it doesn't say communist or anything like that. And he wasn't a communist. He was not political. And we go further down, and this was the biggest mystery of all. The address for the crime scene. It says Kurzheim 16. And that was not his home address because he lives on Alexanderstrasse, and that's further up there in the report. And finally, my researcher went through some telephone books from that period, and this Kurzheim 16 turned out to be the police station. So the crime scene is the police station. That sounds kind of weird. And we'll put two and two and two some more together in a few minutes, and we'll see what was really going on there. And it has that what was seized, one dagger, 31 knuckle dusters, and I don't know what, okay, heavy hands. He had a bicycle shop and he sold stuff. And in those days also, there was a lot of street fighting going on, and if you wanted to protect yourself and you didn't have a gun, you might want like a knuckle duster. But it's very bizarre. But what's not bizarre is one revolver, two pocket pistols, and 20-something rounds of ammunition. And so that was confiscated from him. And in the book, in the illustrations, you'll see the next page of this report also, which I don't have on this, but I'll tell you what was in it. It was actually a four-page report. The next page was criminal act, and it said possession of weapons. It also said cite the section number of the law that makes a criminal. There was no section number to cite, so they didn't cite it because it was not illegal for a Jew to have a weapon at that time. And then it goes on to ask for the statement of facts, and it repeats that the same quantities of weapons that were confiscated. And it says, arms in the hands of Jews are a danger to public safety. Now that sounds familiar, right? Werner Best, the Gestapo guy, had said that in his directive. And then the most important part for our topic, the arms are registered at Police Station 13 on January 26, 1932. Written confirmation is there. So in 1932, he registered his guns with the police during the Weimar period still. And the records are still there. Duh. That's how they knew he had these weapons. So then you look at the rest of the report, and I don't have that illustrated here, and the copies are not in the illustration part of the books, but the translation of it is there. And at the end of the report, basically, it said he's being turned over to Gestapo, which was the other side of the Gestapo. And it doesn't say what happened after that to him. I suspect he was probably interrogated and released after a while. But the curious thing was, when you look at the time of this arrest, and then the next arrest report that we had, it was only about 12 minutes later at the same crime scene, you know, the police station. And so what I know was going on then, it doesn't take too much to surmise, that these Jews had been ordered to turn in their weapons, but that's what they were doing. They were at the police station turning them in, and they were in line. And then the next fella, he gets turned over to the Gestapo as well, and so on. So what do you have here? They registered the guns in the Weimar period. The Nazis know they have them because of the registration records. They're ordered to turn them in, then they're arrested. So they're effectively disarmed, and then the Nazis could move on to the next stage. So the next stage was Kristallnacht. And I'm going to actually point it so they could go. But what it shows you is that it suggests Kristallnacht, not just suggests, but it, I think, proves Kristallnacht was planned by the Nazis. They were getting ready for it. They were disarming the German Jews, and this would make it really easy for them to carry out and make sure there was no resistance. Now, this individual was Hans Reich.
That's probably a good place to stop since we're out of time, but go to booktv.org and take a look at this book, Gun Control, in the Third Reich. And I think you'll find it very interesting. He's done some real in-depth research and looked at a lot of documents and old newspapers, which is outstanding. If you want to get a little picture of history by period and that type of business, there's a great book. I have it on my desk here called The Handy History Answer Book, the second edition by Rebecca Ferguson, The Handy History Answer Book. And all of the pages in the book, it's hundreds of pages. What is it actually? Over 600 pages, has a beautiful index. All the subtitles are questions. So you go from the beginning of time until up to the present time, at least up to like 2006, and Rebecca Ferguson has provided an excellent book that will give you a background for understanding books like the one that we're talking about here. We're here tonight. So that's it for this evening. We'll see you next week, and we'll have Vera Lynn sign us off singing. We'll meet again.
Again, don't know where, don't know when, but I know we'll meet again some sunny day. Keep smiling through, just like you always do. Till the blue skies drive the dark clouds far away. So will you please say hello to the folks that I know. Tell them I won't be long. They'll be happy to know that as you saw me go, I was singing. We'll meet again, don't know where, don't know when, but I know we'll meet again some sunny day.